Welcome to the Voice of Truth on 103.3 WAJR-FM, the radio broadcast ministry of Christian Apostolic Church in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And now, your host, author, teacher, and pastor, Doug Joseph.
Welcome back to part two of our series on personal finances with special guest John Harrison, founder and president of Aspire Financial Advisors. You may have heard of Aspire. Aspire Financial has been featured in a lot of media outlets, including Wealth Magazine, Time, CNN, Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, DallasNews.com, many radio shows. What you may not know is that John Harrison, the founder and president of Aspire Financial Advisors, is not only a certified financial planner, but also an ordained minister of the gospel. John has over 20 years of experience in financial services and over 17 years of experience as an active ordained minister. John is the author of Making Mammon Serve You, an excellent book applying biblical principles to the complicated area of finances. John has a gift for making the complex simple when it comes to explaining things to people in a way that helps them with the decisions they face regarding their finances. Again, this will be a series. It will take us several weeks to cover all the material, but you're going to be blessed by it. If you'd like to buy the book, Making Mammon Serve You, you can go online to aspirefa.com. That stands for Aspire Financial Advisors. Again, it's www.aspirefa.com. And now let's get to the series. Here's John.
You know, there's all these proverbs, the dog has returned to his vomit, and the fool returns to his folly. It's his by default. It's him by default. Seest thou a man wise in his conceits, there's more hope of a fool than of him. The person, it's really saying seeing a person wise in their conceits. But in English, we default to the masculine when sex isn't specified. So it sticks out at me that it says the ant gathers her meat. Now, when this was written all these years ago, I don't know if people had knowledge of something that we know now, we've known since the 20th century, that all worker ants are female. That in an ant colony, there's a queen and there's drones who do nothing by way of work. Drones sit around and wait for mating season and start new colonies, but they don't do any work. All those ants doing the conga line across your kitchen counter are sisters. They're all female workers. The Bible said it that way long before any people actually knew that. So it's just another little tiny thing, a reminder that the Bible is, in fact, the Word of God, that it's true, that it's trustworthy, and that we can believe and rely on what it says about anything and everything, including our money. So it's a great guide. And what it says in this verse about the ant is that in the summer, in the season of opportunity, the ant takes its own fate into its hands and works and gathers so that it gets the result it wants. It survives the winter. And what we're to consider when we go to the ant is that very same thing, and it's empowering. It means we're not helpless. It means that our future is not up to what somebody else does to us or for us. Our future is not about how the economy turns out. The future is not about who gets elected. The future is not about whether or not your employer keeps the pension, but it's about the things that we do. And that's so much more empowering than just hoping that whatever happens to us works out well. It's about what we do. There are seasons of opportunity that if we will work, they will reward us. Now, in terms of gathering, we read the statistics earlier. People are concerned about, one of the biggest things people are concerned about, for instance, is their retirement. So I want to tell you that in that regard, you have three sources of potential income in retirement, and those would be Social Security, an employer pension, and whatever you saved. Now, I want to look at these things because the Bible actually comments about where our emphasis should be. We're in a season right now where many, many people are looking to the government to save them. We are upside down in houses. We have negative equity. We owe more money than the house is worth, and we're hoping the government is going to fix that. and we don't have enough money for retirement, and we're hoping the government's going to fix that. People say, well, if they raise taxes on rich people, give more to me, and you know, it'll work out better that way. And we're hoping that they come up with a solution to get the economy back on its feet, and they come up with a solution to rescue the people who are hurting, and they come up with a solution to create some jobs for people who don't have them. And all of these things, we look to the government and say, do something. I'd like to suggest, very humbly suggest, that maybe you don't want to look to the government for your salvation. Because historically, that hasn't always worked out so well. You all know the story of Joseph. I want to spend a few minutes in our session this morning walking you through the story of Joseph. I know you're familiar, you know who he is and what happened to him in his youth, but I want to look at some things maybe we haven't quite seen this way before, and see what lessons we can derive from it. Genesis chapter 37 begins, and Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob, and I'm going to skip the sons of Zilpah and Bilhah and go down to verse 3. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. Now, this is a mistake on Joseph's part. God gives us dreams, but you do need to be careful who you share them with. And maybe the people who hate you aren't the first people you want to take your God-given dreams to. But Joseph told his dreams to his brethren. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. It bowed. It took a worshipful position before my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us? They knew exactly what that meant. They knew what that imagery meant. Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And I point this out because sometimes we're in a mess. Sometimes we have difficulties that are partly of our own making. Because he didn't have to tell his brethren these things. They hated him already. And they hated him worse for the fact that God had given him this dream and the fact that he told them about it. They hated him for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed another dream and told it his brethren. And behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it his father and to his brethren. His father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I, thy mother, and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. And so there's some dissension there and some tension of Joseph's own making. But the first thing I want you to notice is that even though Joseph made a mistake, a bad mistake, God can prosper you in spite of your mistakes. Maybe you've got financial situations that are your own fault. And you feel bad, you feel guilty because, well, you know, I got myself into this mess. I bought this house and couldn't quite afford it. I bought this car and it was more payment than I really needed. I ran up this debt and I'm not quite sure why. I didn't save enough and now I'm behind. And it's all my fault and you feel a little bit guilty. But what I want you to understand is that God can and does bless people and prosper people in spite of their mistakes. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. So you know the story how that Joseph's brethren devised this plot. And at first they were going to kill Joseph. And one brother interceded and said, no, let's not do that. Let's not have his blood on our hands. And so they threw him in a pit after having stripped his coat of many colors from him. And they told his father that he had been killed by a wild beast. And here's his coat. It's all ripped to shreds and it's covered in blood. Is this your son's? And, you know, they do this plot. And what they've done is sold him to a bunch of Ishmaelite traders who take him down to Egypt and sell him into slavery. Now, what's fascinating about this to me is how God can use the seemingly inconsequential to make a powerful blessing for somebody. Let me say what I mean by that. Inconsequential things. Egypt was the place, I like to say it this way, in a very real sense, Israel was saved by the house cat. And I got your attention now. You're all looking at me strange, like, who is this man, and why did he just say that? Let me explain. Egypt was the country that invented the grain silo. You know those big conical buildings that you see on farms for storing grain in? Egypt invented that. Now, every nation and every city had grain storage, but Egypt invented the silo and was able to store grain on a large scale like no other country could, because they had that technology and no one around them did. Now, there was a problem around the storage of grain. You know what this is. If you have bird seed or something in your garage, if you have grain stored in a shed or a barn, what do you also have in that building? You have mice, somebody said it. You got rodents in that building if you've got grain. And the big problem with grain storage anywhere was that rodents would always invade it and destroy it. Egypt became the first nation to domesticate the house cat. When they domesticated the house cat, they solved their rodent problem. When they solved their rodent problem, they solved the problem with large-scale grain storage. And they built an entire economy based on grain storage. In fact, their currency was on the grain standard, the way our currency used to be on the gold standard. Now, some of y'all don't remember that, but years and years ago, if you had a dollar bill, that dollar bill stood for and was exchangeable for a certain amount of gold on deposit in Fort Knox. 1972, that ended, and things got interesting ever since. But Egypt didn't have a gold standard. They had a grain standard. Every piece of their currency stood for an amount of grain in a silo somewhere. So they had this massive infrastructure built on grain. Now, because of that, Egypt and only Egypt had the infrastructure to store enough grain to sustain Israel and itself through the 7-year famine that we're about to read about is coming. So God used this inconsequential historical fact, the fact that Egypt domesticated the house cat, and turned it so that Joseph ended up in the one place in the world that could have accomplished what needed to be accomplished when the famine hit. God can use things that you don't think will amount to much to anything. Maybe some little thing that I say to you today, inconsequential thing, can become a thing that God can use to absolutely revolutionize your finances. Look for God in the little things, the things that we think aren't important, like, okay, why is he telling me about house cats? Because it mattered to Joseph that Egypt had domesticated the house cat. He didn't know it, but it mattered to him because it was what created the mechanism for his blessing. So he ends up in Egypt, and he's doing the best he can do. He's a slave in Egypt. He's wondering about his dreams and how God's going to bring all these things to pass. Then he's falsely accused, and he's put in prison for a crime he did not commit. And he's just there kind of languishing, and the butler and the baker share their dreams, and he interprets, and they're released to Pharaoh, and they forget about him. But eventually, Pharaoh has a dream. And he's asking for someone to tell him what it means. He dreams that there were these kine, these cows, that came up out of the river Nile, and they were fat and well-favored and good-looking cows. And then these skinny, scrawny, mangy, ill-favored cows came up after them, and they ate the fat cows, but were not themselves made fat. You know, the idea that you can tax the rich people and it will make all the not rich people okay, actually it doesn't work. The skinny ones eat the fat ones, and now no one's fat. It's just... I'll let that sink in. And so Joseph explains to him what his two dreams, the cows, and he had a subsequent one about ears of corn, and he explains that there's going to be this enormous famine. There'll be 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine so bad that you'll forget about the plenty. It'll be famine like no one's ever seen. And here's what you do. You appoint a wise and discerning person over Egypt to take up 20% of what the land produces in the good years, and you set it aside. See, there's that infrastructure again. They were able to do this. No one else could have. And you set it aside, and you save it as a reserve, as a store against the years of lack, against the famine. And that seemed like a great idea to Pharaoh. In chapter 41, at verse 42, it says, Pharaoh said unto Joseph, See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. Now, he had been in prison an hour before. What I want you to see is that your turnaround does not have to be slow. He waited a long time for it. But when it came quickly. He went from an anonymous guy in a prison. And when the butler remembered about him interpreting the dream, he said he was brought out of the prison and he got cleaned up and shaved and went before Pharaoh. And next thing you know, he's in charge of the country. So your turnaround can be quick. Isn't it wonderful to serve a God so awesome that no matter how far you've fallen, he can pull you up high and he can pull you up fast. That's all over the Bible. You read about the famine in Samaria later when the prophet said, about this time tomorrow shall the measure of, you know, it doesn't have to be long in God's economy. And so Joseph is in charge and he sets about doing what he says. Bible says that he went and he gathered the grain from all over the land, that it was so much that it wasn't countable, that they left off counting. There just was so much gathered. I want you to understand that what they did was they taxed the people 20% of all their production. And they set it aside for when the years of famine came. And then the years of famine came, and I want you to see what happens in chapter 41 and verse 56. And the famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses, and what's the next word? Sold. Not gave. Sold. Now, it was their grain in the first place. They grew it. He taxed it. He took 20% of everything they grew and set it aside. And when they ran out, they had to come by and buy, purchase, pay for that which they had grown themselves on their own land. That concept still exists, you know. You pay for Social Security with a tax. If you make a certain amount of money in your retirement, the benefit you get from Social Security is taxable. They don't just give you your money back. So he sells to the Egyptians, and he doesn't sell at a nice fixed price. He doesn't sell at a nice low price to everybody. It's an auction. Because the Bible makes clear that hyperinflation sets in. The money failed. You know what inflation is? You hear that word in the media all the time. Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. There was lots of money, there wasn't a lot of grain. So the price of grain went up. And people bid it up. And the Bible says that the money failed. And the second year, people came and said, well, we're out of money. What do we do? We don't want to starve. And so Joseph said, well, for your cattle, your herds, your flocks, I'll give you grain. So now the state has just taken over the means of production. The things that produce the income, the things that produce the goods that used to belong to the independent farmers now belong to Pharaoh. They sold them to him for food. And the following year, their flocks are gone, their herds are gone, they've got no more money, and they still need food. And Joseph says to them, well, you sell us the land you live on, and yourselves servants to Pharaoh, and I'll feed you. So the government took care of them simply in exchange for their freedom. They started out as independent farmers on their own land and ended up as feudal serfs to Pharaoh, sharecropping on his land. Ronald Reagan years ago said the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Did Joseph save Egypt? Yes, he did. Was there a price for it? Yes, there was. So when we think about looking to the government to save us financially, remember, anything the government does for you is going to come at a price. It may be a higher price than you want to pay. So the Bible said, consider the ant, rather than looking to what somebody in the government or somebody in your employer will do for you, think about the things that you can do for yourself. And those things are where your economic and financial well-being are going to come from. So I said that there were three places you could get money, for instance, in your retirement. Your income will come from Social Security. That's the government. We've talked a little bit about that. And there's employer pensions is another source, but those are going away. For all you young people in the room, I want to explain pensions because that may be a really foreign concept. In the old days, your company kept paying you after you stopped working. You worked at a company for 20, 30, 40 years, and then you retired, And they kept paying you for not showing up. And at a good company, that pay had a cost of living increase built into it, so your pay went up every year as inflation did. But companies started figuring out that it's hard to keep doing that, because every so often, this generation of employees would retire and keep getting paid, and they'd have to hire new people to actually do the work and pay them too, and they kept paying more and more people, and companies were going bankrupt over this. It was like having an absentee problem. Someone did a study in the auto industry a few years ago and found that, for instance, Nissan Motor Corporation had retired pensioners equal to about 10% of its workforce, meaning it was like having 10% of the workforce not show up every day and still get a paycheck. Not so bad. Honda had 12. Ford, Chrysler had 153%. Ford had 181%. General Motors had 318 retired people on a pension for every 100 people who were working. There's a reason why all those pensions imploded, and there's a reason why companies don't do that anymore. So all you young folks, when you grow up and get a job, they're not going to keep paying you after you quit. So what we're left with is, if the government's not our salvation, and if the employer is not going to be our salvation, it's going to be up to us to do something like that ant, and in the season of opportunity, set aside something that will work for us so that we can prosper when retirement day comes. And by retirement, I don't mean that, you know, that you have to necessarily quit working. Retirement is the time at which full-time work becomes optional. It's the time at which, if you want to work, you do. If you don't, you don't. And you don't have to in order to keep food on the table. That's what retirement is. And you want to be able to reach that point and still live well. And that will come down to being shrewd with the choices that you make with your money and setting something aside like that ant does. Are you with me so far? All right. Well, let me share with you an idea that is one of those big picture forest ideas and not tree ideas, not tiny detail ideas. We said in our statistics session that 56% of Americans don't know how much money they'll need, how much income they'll need at retirement, so how much money they need to accumulate. They don't know. But even if you're part of that minority group that knows how much you'll need, you probably have a problem, and here's why. Where is most people's retirement money located? Where do they put it in? It's typically in a 401k, a 403b, or an IRA, right? Those are all wonderful things. But there's a problem with the traditional 401k and the traditional 403b and the traditional IRA or any of those qualified plans you might have at your job. Some people have what's called simples. Some people have SEPs. There's all sorts of different things. But they all essentially work on the same principle. You put money in pre-tax, they grow tax-free, it's taxable when you take it out. Here's the problem. When you have one of those accounts, you have a silent partner on that account. Now, the account's only in your name. That IRA is IRA for benefit of, your name is in the blank. Yours is the only name on it. Well, that 401k, yours is the only name on it. But you don't realize you have a silent partner on that account. And that partner is Uncle Sam. It's the government. Now, I already gave you a good feeling about the government by reading about Joseph. And one of the things you've got to realize about these tax-deferred accounts is that your withdrawals are taxable when you take them at whatever tax rate you're at then. In other words, what you've done is you've entered into a contract with Uncle Sam and said, look, you let me save tax-deferred now, and you let the money grow tax-deferred until I retire and withdraw it, and then you can tell me how much of it you want. And maybe he'll want 20%, and maybe he'll want 35%, and maybe he'll want 50%. Maybe he'll want more. When John F. Kennedy was president, the highest tax rate in this country was 77%. If you listen to what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now, are many politicians talking about lower taxes in the future or more? Higher. Does government ever want less money from people? You read the story of Joseph, one of the details in there that I didn't mention was that in order to pay to get them through this famine, he instituted that 20% tax on the produce of the land, right? You read the end of chapter 41, and you'll discover that he made that permanent. That 20% that went to Pharaoh was perpetual after that. There's no such thing as a temporary tax. Once government gets something, they always want it. So the famine was long over, but that 20% didn't stop when the famine ended. It just stayed forever. And so when I think about my tax-deferred accounts and the fact that the government is going to want something, and I don't know how much, but I basically have a contract with him that says whatever he wants at the time, he'll tell me, and I'll have to give him that. Maybe a shrewd use of my money now would be to get rid of that silent partner on my account and know that I own whatever is in my account and it will all be mine when I take it. Because how can you figure out whether or not you have enough if you don't know how much of what you have the government will want? I have $500,000 in my account, but I don't know how much of that I'll get to keep because the government's going to want some of it and they'll tell me how much in 20 years. So there was a senator from Delaware named William Roth. And I think William Roth should have gotten his picture on a box of Wheaties. Because he figured out something that none of the people who came before him had figured out. And that's simply this, that a tax break on a small amount of money is not worth as much as a tax break on a large amount of money. And what a traditional retirement plan gives you is a tax break on the small amount of money you contribute to it. And when it grows into a big sum of money over here, then they want the taxes when you take it out. So what William Roth said is, tell you what, we'll let you put money somewhere with no tax advantage on the small contribution. You put after-tax dollars in. But it'll grow tax-free, and when you take it out, it's all yours, no taxes. Because you know what? Not only is a tax break on a large amount of money worth more than a tax break on a small amount of money, but now you can plan because you know how much spendable cash is in the account. With a traditional retirement plan, you know how much money is there, but you don't know how much is spendable because you don't know how much the government's going to take. And so Roth did one other great thing. Besides creating what we now call the Roth IRA and its corollaries, the Roth 401k and the Roth 403b, you can convert traditional plans to Roth plans. So if you say, well, all of my money is in a traditional IRA, all of my money is in a traditional 401k, that's okay, you can convert it. And you know what you're doing? You are effectively buying out your silent partner at today's known rates. Think about it. Hallelujah. It's like that unjust steward. It's a shrewd thing to do. We know how much money the government wants today. By converting traditional retirement plans to their Roth equivalents, when you do the conversion, you pay tax now on the amount you convert. But you're buying out that silent partner at today's known rates and getting his name off your account and will never be back on it. And the rest of the growth you get will come out tax-free when you take it in retirement. That's a good thing to do. And so that's just one little, the details are many and numerous, but the big picture, the forest is, I'd rather have my name and my name alone on the account and not the silent partner who's going to want an unknown amount. Let me get rid of him now, and then I can deal with the details. That's just one of the shrewd things that people can do with their money. There's a reason we care about these things. It's not just so we can live better, have a bigger house, have a bigger car, have the second house, take the nicer vacation. I've got no problem with all of those things, by the way. If you can do those things and do them responsibly, wonderful. I don't have a problem with people having nice things. But the main reason we want to accumulate money is because we now know what money is. It's a tool for accomplishing the purpose of God in our life. It's a thing we will use to do good works with. It's a thing we will use to send missionaries. It's a thing we will use to build churches. It's a thing we will use to feed the hungry. And now we can do it and get excited about it because we're not too fearful to do it, wondering, but how.
Again, this will be a series. It will take us several weeks to cover all the material. If you'd like to buy the book, Making Mammon Serve You, you can go online to aspirefa.com. That stands for Aspire Financial Advisors. Again, it's www.aspirefa.com.
Thank you for listening. You can reach us online at cac.us.com. Catch the Voice of Truth broadcast each Sunday morning at 11:30 right here on Talk Radio 103.3 WAJR-FM.